Shalom Hadavarnik. Welcome to our next session in the book in the First Regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel. We're in session number 22, dealing with Israel present. So let's review where we have been in our previous session. In our previous session, we dealt with the Karain A Palestinian freighter being captured. And here's a picture of the $15 million worth of arms that were taken off the ship, put on display for the world to see. These arms are illegal for the PA to own under the agreement signed with Israel, and yet they were being smuggled in by a PA ship, piloted by a PA captain, to the Gaza Strip. In January of 2002, the first woman suicide bomber killed herself, Wafa Idris, and here she is with her mother. In February 2002, Qassam missiles and launchers were discovered in the West Bank. March 2002, the UN Security Council endorses a Palestinian state. March 28, 2002, the Passover massacre occurred at the Park Hotel. And this was a good time. I suggested that you read Israel, or not read, but view Israel in Time of Terror by Dennis Prager, available from Vanguard. It covers this time, very difficult time in Israel's history, very well. March 29th, 2002, Operation Protective Wall was instigated to crack down on terror, to destroy terrorist infrastructure, to confiscate weapons, and to arrest fugitives. Yasser Arafat's compound was breached, and many incriminating documents of his involvement in terrorism were discovered. Operation Protective Wall then expanded from Ramallah, which is Yasser Arafat's headquarters, to Qalqiya, to Nablus, to Jenin, to Karam, and to Bethlehem. Tanzim leader Marwan Barghouti was arrested during Operation Protective Wall. He was hiding out in the in a building near Arafat's compound. Again, remember, he's the leader of the Tanzim. A number of terrorists took shelter in the Church of the Nativity when the IDF rolled into Bethlehem. After a siege of some month or so, they were finally deported to countries in the Mediterranean area. Israel entered the Jenin refugee camp during Operation Protective Wall and faced heavy fighting. Israel was then accused of creating a massacre. Well, after all the massacre allegations were examined, it was determined that no massacre occurred in Jenin. Here's a cartoon with Kofi Annan reading the UN report to Yasser Arafat. He says, "I'm sorry, there was no massacre in Jenin." And of course, Yasser Arafat complains, "With blood on his hands and a bomb in his hand, as usual, the UN favors Israel." Just the opposite, isn't it? The pressure put on Arafat by Operation Protective Wall, that pressure plus pressure from other countries caused Arafat to so-called shake up his government, to reform his government. It wasn't much of a reform. Before the reform, his government was made up of 32 Arafat clones, and after the reform, it was made up of 21 Arafat clones. Big change, huh? June 17, 2002, the 34th Zionist Congress met only to discover some very chilling statistics. 51% of the Palestinians favor the liberating of all historic Palestine. 71% of the Palestinians supported terrorist attacks against civilians, and 48% supported attacks inside of Israel. And so a security force fence went up. It's made up of 97% chain link and 3% concrete wall. Yet it's the concrete wall that gets all the publicity so that the media can accuse Israel of creating another Berlin Wall and of apartheid. But why does the wall exist? It exists as a bullet shadow to protect the cars traveling at the base of the wall from snipers. And the wall has been effective. As the wall got constructed, the suicide and bomb attacks went down. In 2002, when the wall was not constructed, there were 59 suicide and bomb attacks. Then in 2003, when the wall was about 25% done, that number had dropped to 25 attacks. In 2004, the wall was about half finished. The suicide attacks had dropped to 14. In 2005, the wall had progressed a little farther. The suicide attacks dropped to 7. In 2006, the wall was about 3/4 finished, and the number of attacks were 4. The wall was finished in 2007. Only one attack ensued. 2008, one attack ensued. And in 2009, there's none recorded. June 24, 2002, Operation Determined Path was instituted under a new strategy that Israel would be confiscating territory each time an attack occurred, more and more territory. September 2002, Israel is winning the Al-Aqsa Mosque, winning the Al-Aqsa Intifada because, number one, of Palestinian impoverishment. The Al-Aqsa Intifada has caused tremendous disruption to the Palestinian economy. Two, Palestinian depression. With all this going on, life cannot return to normal. And three, Palestinian recruitment woes. They're finding it harder and harder to recruit terrorists and suicide bombers. Former Israeli minister, Foreign Minister Abba Iban died. Then there was the shuttle disaster in February 2003, and Israel lost their astronaut Ilan Ramon. In the end of 2003, Ariel Sharon announced the intent of unilateral disengagement, and that brings us to our new material. Now, on February 13, 2004, the White House accepts the idea of unilateral disengagement. The White House declares that the unilateral disengagement from Gaza may help ease tensions between the two parties, but that a final settlement must be reached through negotiations. March 22, 2004, the IDF kills Hamas founder Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Israel assassinated the spiritual leader of the Islamic terrorist group Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, and this is Sheikh Yassin, as he emerged from a mosque in Gaza City. Israeli helicopters fired 3 missiles at the wheelchair-bound Yassin, killing him, his son, and several bodyguards. The attack sent some 200,000 Palestinians onto the streets for the funeral, and they chanted slogans calling for revenge. The leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, is stated as saying, "Words cannot express the emotion of anger and hate inside our hearts." The killing of Yassin was condemned across the world, in the Arab states, Europe, and in the UN. America, however, which is leading the fight on terrorism, did not criticize Israel. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice had this to say. She said, "Let's remember that Hamas is a terrorist organization and that Sheikh Yassin has himself, personally, we believe, been involved in terrorist planning." So since the beginning of the Oslo War in September of 2000, Hamas has perpetrated 425 terrorist attacks of various types, killing a total of 277 Israelis and wounding 2,076 civilians and soldiers. The decision to kill Yassin at the earliest opportunity was made 2 days after a double Hamas attack on the Ashdod port that killed 10 Israelis. At a meeting of top Israeli defense and political leaders, it was decided to embark on a full-scale campaign to wipe out terrorism in Gaza, with both religious and political terrorist leaders in the crosshairs. So Israel is basically saying, enough is enough. But 15 years later, terrorism still thrives. March 24, 2004, Abdul Al-Aziz Rantisi is chosen as the new leader of Hamas. Here is Abdul Aziz Rantisi. He was one of the 6 founders of Hamas in September 1987, along with Ahmed Yassin. April 17, 2004, Israeli security forces kill Abdul Aziz Rantisi. Rantisi took part in establishing the terrorist policy of the organization and also served as its main spokesman. He played a key and active role in inciting and carrying out terror attacks. April 18, 2004, Mahmoud Zahar becomes the new leader of Hamas. And this is Mahmoud al-Zahar. Hamas does not publicly announce Rantisi's successor out of fear that Israel will target him. May 19, 2004, Marwan Barghouti is convicted of murder for his involvement in three terrorist attacks in Israel that killed five people. He's the Tanzim leader, the leader of the youth militia. He was acquitted of 33 other murders due to lack of evidence of his direct involvement in those crimes. June 14, 2004. This is an article came out that I'd like to share with you called Rude Shocks from Cultured Folks. I'd like to read that article and then respond to it. It appeared in the Jerusalem Report on June 14, 2004, written by David Margulies. He writes, "Increasingly decent people on the left seem either to disdain Israel or to view its disappearance as a necessary step toward a perfected world. This international plague, the increasing, unthinking assumption that Israel is, at best, all wrong, has infected even the nominally Zionist Jewish left. Pundits provide reasons for this. Ignorance of the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, Israel's association with colonialist America, Prime Minister Sharon's connection to Sabra and Shatila, now the evil Bush, Israel's defective public relations and Palestinian success in portraying themselves as victims, and a well-oiled Arab anti-Israel propaganda campaign, to name a few." All true, all true. Yet somehow, none of that fully explains why thoughtful friends in San Francisco have become partisans of the Palestinian cause, let alone why Portuguese Nobel Prize novelist José Saramago compared Israel's treatment of Palestinians to Auschwitz. And anti-fascist Greek composer Mikis Theodorakis called Jews the root of evil. Decent folks, all of them. And I mean it. My friends are cultured and tolerant people, with whom I share a wide range of political and lifestyle opinions. Yet they seem unmoved that part of the Palestinian design remains the destruction of Israel. So I fish for explanations where politics mixes with the metaphysical, with God, with religion. Does the Jews' near-miraculous national rebirth and homecoming insult the left's religion of universalism by suggesting once again the Jews' uniqueness? Well, that's a question that needs more expansion, but we don't have time to do that here, the left's religion of universalism. But does that near-miraculous national rebirth have anything to do with it? Because the Jews are unique. And I need to respond, yes, David, in Amos 3:2, it's very clear, You only have I chosen among all the families of the earth. Yes, we are a unique people. We are the chosen people. And with that comes certain consequences. He goes on, or is the left's rancor merely an expression of the antagonism toward Jews that seems built into the world's foundation, as if God himself put it there? Well, God himself didn't put it there, but there is a principle that impacts our nation. In Isaiah 40 verse 2, we run across the principle, "Speak kindly to Jerusalem and call out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity has been removed," and here's the key sentence, "that she has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins." See, you see, we are the chosen people. We are the chosen nation, and that is a double blessing. And with double blessing comes double responsibility. We are to be God's witnesses in the world. And we haven't responded to that responsibility. And so with double responsibility, when we shirk double responsibility, we incur double discipline. Double discipline. We will never be destroyed because this double discipline, double for all our sins, will reach an end, and the Messianic kingdom will be instituted. But for now, when we sin, we receive from the Lord's hand double for all our sins. Now, my friends are not anti-Semites. More on that later. More on that in just a few minutes. My friends are not anti-Semites, to be sure. But I wonder if they might be like canaries in a mine, unaware as they fall before the daily vapors. And that could be expanded. That question could be expanded even more theologically. And beyond both politics and metaphysics, how shall I cope personally as my good friends become also my enemies? And that's a tough question, isn't it? Well, my response to David's article, and this is not a full response, but it's all I can do for right now. David, you're right. Anti-Semitism makes no sense unless you understand the satanic cause behind all the hatred. On one side sits Satan, the adversary, who desires to usurp God and be like God, Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28. On the other hand, God has entered into an eternal, unconditional, and unilateral covenant with the Jewish people, the Abrahamic covenant. That covenant consists of three basic promises: the land promise, expanded and developed by the land covenant; the seed promise, expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant; and the spiritual blessing promise, expanded and developed by the new covenant. If any of these three legs of the Abrahamic covenant are unfulfilled or perverted, then God cannot fulfill the Abrahamic covenant. Satan can then rightfully declare that God is not the promise-keeping, all-powerful, loving King of Kings, and he would claim the throne of the universe. Satan tried to destroy the spiritual blessing promise, the new covenant, when he saw Yeshua to the cross. Ironically, his action against Yeshua actually fulfilled that leg of the Abrahamic covenant. The spiritual blessing promise and the new covenant are now unassailable. However, two legs of the Abrahamic covenant are still vulnerable: the land promise, the land covenant, and the seed promise, the Davidic covenant. Consequently, Satan's obsession lies in destroying or perverting these two promises and their related covenants. If Satan can destroy the Jewish people, he has shattered the seed promise. Therefore, he continually arouses the nations and people of the world system to eradicate the Jewish people. That's anti-Semitism, David. The most current example of this is the Holocaust of World War II, when we lost 6 million to the Nazi death machine. So there's the background to anti-Semitism. Let's go on. If Satan can destroy the nation of Israel, he can demolish the land promise or the land covenant. Therefore, he continually arouses the nations and people of the world system to wipe out the state of Israel. The most current expression is the vitriol directed against the modern state of Israel. David, this is the root of anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism. Adding the satanic element to the explanation, which most do not, provides the answer to David Margulies' question. We are a unique people with a unique relationship to God. Consequently, we are involved in the most unique and significant war ever waged. In a nutshell, Satan is attempting to save his own skin. He knows that once the Abrahamic covenant is fulfilled, his career is over. He faces an eternity of judgment and horror in the lake of fire. The war is a spiritual war. Satan against God, good against evil, winner take all. And the Bible explains it all. Satan does not stand a chance. God wins, and by the way, I might add there, quite handily. Good triumphs, evil is eradicated, and eternal life is experienced by those who trust in him. So this is a partial explanation regarding anti-Semitism. I should have added there anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and its root cause. I will provide additional biblical information dealing with this question and the question of Jewish occupation of the Promised Land when I get to my article about the Gaza handover in just a few minutes. All right, let's move on to June 18, 2004. The Second Intifada is over, and Israel has won, according to the opinion of columnist Charles Krauthammer, after 4 years, 1,000 deaths, thousands of others maimed and wounded. June 30th, 2004. The Israeli High Court upholds Israel's right to build the security fence, but they make a slight modification in the route. So the government did not have a free hand in building this fence. It had to be vetted by the High Court. It had to be looked at by other members of the culture of the country. July 4th, 2004. The International Court of Justice criticizes the security fence. They issued a non-binding advisory opinion that Israel's security fence violates international law. They said. It's kind of wrong to protect yourself. You know, this decision comes out of the one world government, Nations Without Borders fixation that's taken hold of Europe and now in the United States, although it's being opposed in the United States here. One world government, Nations Without Borders. We shouldn't have borders and fences so people can just flow across the world and live where they want to live. Well, they've forgotten one thing. Israel was outraged by the ruling, saying the world court ignored the issue of Palestine suicide bombers. What if suicide bombers want to come into your country and flow across the border unimpeded? So Israel said the barrier will remain in place to keep bombers out of the country. Well, of course, the Palestinians welcome the ICJ decision as historic. This is an excellent decision, said Yasser Arafat. Why would it be excellent? Because it supports terrorism. It opens the door very wide to terrorism. It takes down the impediments to getting into Israel and killing people, causing terror. In February, Israel felt that approximately 30 countries, including the European Union and the United States, felt that The Hague did not have the authority to rule on the legality of its security barrier. Israel's case for the barrier is simple. It's necessary to keep suicide bombers out of the country. Fences do good neighbors make. An absolute halt in terrorist activities has been noticed in the West Bank areas where the fence has been constructed. Infiltrations into Israeli territory have emanated from areas where the fence has not yet been completed. Israeli cities that had been the target now have been quiet since the fence has been erected. So the fence speaks for itself. October 13, 2004, Sanhedrin is reconvened, a unique ceremony, probably only the second of its kind in 1,600 years, took place in Tiberias, the launching of a Sanhedrin, the highest Jewish legal tribunal in the land of Israel. The Sanhedrin, a religious assembly that convened in one of the Holy Temple chambers in the Jerusalem Temple, comprised 71 sages and existed during the Tanaitic period. The Tanaitic period runs from several decades before the Common Era until roughly 425 CE, 425 AD. Details of the ceremony are still sketchy, but the organizers announced their intention to convene 71 rabbis who have received special rabbinic ordination specified by Rabbi Maimonides. October 25th, doctors arrive to treat Arafat. Israel has given permission to a team of doctors from Tunisia to fly to Ramallah to treat Yasser Arafat, who's been suffering from gallstones, intestinal infection, a high fever, and vomiting. The doctors entered the Mukata compound on Saturday night, where Arafat has been confined for over 2.5 years. Arafat's health has recently been on the decline, and Egyptian doctors have reportedly already been at Arafat's side for a week. Although his aides deny that he is seriously ill, the emergency call indicates that he's suffering from more than the common flu, and according to some reports, Arafat, who suffers also from Parkinson's disease, may have to fly abroad for surgery. October 27, 2004, Ariel Sharon's pullout plan wins resounding victory in the Knesset. The Knesset voted 67-45 with 7 abstentions to approve the plan. November 11, 2004, Arafat dies. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's death continued to deteriorate. On October 28, Egyptian, Tunisian, and Jordanian doctors were treating him. He was falling in and out of consciousness. On October 29th, he was flown from Jordan to Paris, France, for emergency medical treatment. Senior Palestinian officials began to plan for a change in leadership. On November 11th, Pastor Yasser Arafat slipped into his final coma and died in Paris. The cause of his death is undetermined. Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen is elected to succeed Arafat as the chairman of the PLO. Arafat was buried in Ramallah on November 12, 2004. This is the tomb of Yasser Arafat in Ramallah. This is the tombstone and the Palestinian honor guard that looks over the gravesite. Palestinian terror groups did what? Guess. Yeah, you guessed it right. They accused Israel of poisoning Arafat and vowed revenge. Israel is always behind everything. All right, we're now in 2005. We move to 2005. We pick it up in January 9th, 2005. The Palestinian Authority election. The Palestinian Authority election elected Mahmoud Abbas as the chosen president of the PA. He remains president until this very day. I'm recording in 2019. January 24, 2005, the first ever commemoration of the Holocaust by the UN. It only took them 60 years to acknowledge the Holocaust. February 8, 2005, there's a summit meeting at Sharm el-Sheikh. It was attended by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, and Jordan King Abdullah, during which Sharon and Abbas declared an end to violence. Jordan proposes deploying Palestinian soldiers in the northern part of the West Bank. Israel approves the offer, although the plan is never put into effect. Jordan also deploys an ambassador as well, an ambassador to Israel. February 9, 2005, a reestablished Sanhedrin convenes to discuss the Temple Mount. So there's a lot of interest in rebuilding that third temple. February 6, 2005, Knesset approves the Disengagement Implementation Law. The law compensates Jews who will be evacuated from the Gaza Strip as a result of the disengagement plan. March 16, 2005, Israel transfers control of Jericho to the Palestinians. March 17th, multiple Palestinian groups agree to an informal truce until the end of the year. So things are looking very bright in March, aren't they? March 21st, 2005, Israel transfers the control of Tul Karim to the PA. Everything's still looking good. May 26, 2005, Abbas claims that the PA is willing to work with Israel to help plan the disengagement from Gaza. Everybody was very, very hopeful, or a lot of high hopes, until June 29th, 2005. More than 50 mortars are fired at Israel from across the northern border. Corporal Uzi Peretz of the Golani Brigade is killed and four soldiers wounded, including the unit's doctor. Fire was exchanged, and helicopters and planes attacked five Hezbollah outposts. July 12th, it continues. A Palestinian Islamic Jihad suicide bombing kills five in Netanya. Israel responds by re-entering Tul Karim, and Hamas increases rocket attacks in the south. So the terrorism and violence simply picks up again. August 15, 2005, Israeli soldiers begin to give notices to settlers in Gaza that they must evacuate their homes within 48 hours or they will be forcibly removed. Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz indicates that Israel intends to hold on to the main settlement blocks in the West Bank and in the Jordan Valley. August 17, 2005, forcible evacuation of Jews in Gaza begins, so Israel follows through on their unilateral disengagement plan. And here is the Gaza Strip. The Israeli settlements in Gaza consisted of Nisanit, Netzarim, Kfar Dorom, and Gush Katif. Here is a photograph of the forced evacuation of Kfar Darom. You can see the residents of Kfar Darom on the roof of the building using barbed wire and other means to impede the soldiers that are assigned to remove them from the Gaza Strip. And it was a very, very emotional time in Israel as Jewish men had to force their Jewish brothers out of their homes. Very, very difficult for both sides. August 22, 2005, the disengagement from the Gaza Strip is completed. August 23, 2005, disengagement from four settlements in the northern Samaria are completed. August 29, 2005, Sharon declares there will be no more disengagements. Future territorial concessions will be handled in accordance with the roadmap. And he reiterated that the large settlement blocks would remain in Israel. September 20th, 2005, the last army units leave settlements in Ganim and Kadim in northern Samaria. Now, at this point, I'd like to read my article and comment on my article, The Gaza Handover, that I wrote for Hadavar Messianic Ministries. I wrote, recently, from 1991 to the present, the United States and Israeli governments have been accused of ungodly decision-making from those who espouse fervent religious Zionist and Christian Zionist theology. These two governments are criticized for the philosophy of giving up land for peace. The latest accusations stem from the recent Hurricane Katrina natural disaster and the turnover of the Gaza Strip settlements to the Palestinian Authority in August and September of 2005. However, these accusations are unwarranted because they ignore pertinent biblical and historical facts. First of all, possession of the land is contingent on obedience to the Mosaic Covenant and the Land Covenant. We, the Jewish people, are currently not obedient to the Mosaic Covenant or the Land Covenant. The Mosaic Covenant continues to be God's administrating covenant for those Jewish people who have not entered the New Covenant. And the Land Covenant is a subset of the unconditional and eternal Abrahamic Covenant, and it will not be fully realized until the Messianic Kingdom. And currently, we are not obedient to the Mosaic or Land Covenant. 90% of the Jewish people today are atheist or agnostic. Those 10% who are religious follow the traditions of the rabbis rather than the written word of God. Only 1% or less of the Jewish community today trusts Yeshua as Messiah and Savior. Thirdly, the Jewish people have been promised the entire western arm of the Fertile Crescent, from the Euphrates River to the River of Egypt, and from the eastern wilderness to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, here is a map of the boundaries of the promised land during the Messianic Kingdom. This is the entire land, promised land that has been promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Please note that Sinai to the southwest and the Arabian Peninsula to the southeast are not part of the promised land. Now, we, the Jewish people, have never possessed all of the promised land, and we do not do so today. So not possessing the Gaza Strip is not that unusual. So here are the boundaries of the promised land in the Messianic Kingdom, and this black line is the boundaries of the modern state of Israel, right here. We do not possess all the land of the promised land today, and we haven't during most of our existence. And so the Gaza handover is simply an experience of contraction like those that have occurred in the past. Now, the principle operating on is the fact that Jewish ownership of the land is unconditional. That's based on the Abrahamic covenant because it's an unconditional covenant. However, enjoyment of the land blessing, the land promise, is contingent on obedience, and that's from the land covenant, which is a subset of the Abrahamic covenant. It's contingent on obedience. We will be disciplined for disobedience to the point of exile, but the land still belongs to the Jewish people. So remember these two principles. Here's the principle of expansion, just one example of it, Deuteronomy 19:8 and 9. if, it's conditional, notice, if the Lord your God enlarges your territory just as he has sworn to your fathers and gives you all the land which he's promised to give your fathers. So here in Deuteronomy, before we've entered the land, it's recognized that we may not possess all the land. God has to enlarge our borders and give us all the land. Now, what is that contingent upon? If you carefully observe all the commandment which I command you today to love the Lord your God and to walk in his ways, then. So expansion and enlargement of the territory depends upon obedience. If God will enlarge our territory, he will do it if we carefully observe all the commandments. And then the verse says, you shall add three more cities for yourself besides these three. And in the context, he's speaking about cities of refuge. So if we obey the commandments and God then blesses us by enlarging our borders, we're going to need three more cities of refuge to occupy that territory. So that's the one example of the principle of expansion. Here's the principle of contraction. We find the principle voiced in 2 Kings 10, 31 and 32. But Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord. He was a bad king. Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel to sin. So we have a bad king on the throne following idolatry. And what was the result? In those days, the Lord began to cut off portions from Israel, and Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. So God was saying, enough is enough. Discipline is coming. Discipline is coming. And so the Lord began to reduce the territory that the Jewish people were enjoying under the Abrahamic covenant. All right. On this chart, the Gaza handover is only considered as part of the peace process, and the percentages that I show are approximate. So let's see how this all works out on a chart. Now, this chart is the ancient possession of the land. Okay? Here's the time period and the approximate percentage of occupation or control. We start with Abraham. Abraham occupied and owned and controlled just a tiny, tiny, tiny portion of the land, just a drop. And so I've just got him down around 0%. But after the Exodus, when we entered the land during the time of the judges, we occupied up to 20%, mostly the hill country. We began to occupy and cast the Canaanites out as God commanded. When we come to the United Kingdom under Saul, David, and Solomon, our occupation and control of the Promised Land expands tremendously up to approximately 70%. Now, this map shows Solomon's kingdom, Jewish control of the land to its greatest extent to date. Here we begin with the United Kingdom under Saul. He controlled this pink area. And then his successor of the United Kingdom was David. David was a godly man, a man after God's own heart. And God blessed the nation and David's kingdom by expanding our borders. And then in the beginning, Solomon was a man after God's own heart. And so our control of the land expanded all the way up to the Euphrates River. Of course, at the end of his reign, Solomon's wives turned his heart against the Lord and discipline came. But during our heyday, at the very peak of Solomon's kingdom, we did control the territory all the way to the Euphrates River, as God stated, although there was still at least 30% of the land that we did not control, to the north and to the west. All right, so that's the United Kingdom. That then the kingdom split over taxes, and we began to lose territory as Hazael began to chop off chunks from the northern kingdom. Finally, the Assyrian conquest finished the job by destroying the northern kingdom and sending the Jewish people out into exile. The Babylonians then finished off the southern kingdom a number of years later, and the whole nation was in exile, the 70-year exile to Babylon. After 70 years, we then returned to the land of Israel. During the Hellenistic period, we conquered the Greeks and gained our land back, up to 40% of our land. But then the Romans came in and we lost a land again, back down to, we'll say, 30%. And finally, with our rebellion against Rome in 70 AD and 135 AD, we slipped into the first worldwide dispersion, and those Jewish people that occupied the land were minuscule. Minuscule, believe me. All right, let's look at the modern position of the land. Has it changed at all? We start in the first worldwide dispersion. The Jews are dispersed all over the land for 2,000 years. Then the first worldwide regathering begins. God begins to regather. It's 1839 to 1948. We begin to buy back our own land, maybe 10% of it. During the War of Independence in 1948, we gained back huge swaths of land. Up to 30% of the land becomes occupied by the Jewish people. During the Six-Day War, we gained some more. We gained the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And we're up to maybe 40% of control of the Promised Land. And this remains pretty consistent from 1967 through 73, the Yom Kippur War, through the Lebanon War of 1982, and through the Gulf War of 1990. But then the so-called peace process begins. Land for peace, and we begin to lose land. Well, where will we go in the near future? Well, I don't know. I can't tell you which direction it will go. We'll just have to wait and see God's will in the near future. However, we do know what will happen in the far future. We do know that there will be a second worldwide dispersion in the middle of the tribulation period. It will be very, very short, 3.5 years, but it'll be very, very intense. The Antichrist will kill off 2/3 of the worldwide Jewish community. And then, when it looks like the Jewish community is on the verge of extinction, Yeshua will return. He'll destroy Israel's enemies. He'll destroy his enemies. And he will institute the Messianic Kingdom. He will institute the second worldwide regathering of Isaiah 11:11. And we will finally possess all of the promised land. All 100% of the promised land. So while the Mosaic Covenant and the Land Covenant promise restoration after a worldwide dispersion, the restoration of Israel comes in two stages. A study of the prophets indicates there will be two worldwide regatherings. This might be new to you, but here's a chart that summarizes the two worldwide regatherings. We'll look at the number, the characteristic, the purpose, when it is experienced, and the scripture. So the first worldwide regathering is characterized by unbelief. Its purpose is judgment that will be experienced during the tribulation period. And one verse that speaks of this is Ezekiel 20:33-38. There are more, but that's a key one right there. The second worldwide regathering is characterized by faith. Its purpose is blessing, the blessing of the kingdom. Isaiah 11, verses 11 and 12 are one of the verses that speak of that second worldwide regathering. However, today, and in this study, we are studying and we are experiencing the first worldwide regathering in unbelief, because 80 to 90% of the Israelis are atheist or agnostic for the purpose of judgment. We'll experience this during the tribulation. The tribulation is bearing down on us like a freight train. And so that is why we should reach out to our Jewish brothers and sisters with the good news of the gospel of Jesus, the Messiah, the good news of Jesus. Now, back to the Gaza Strip. In particular, the Gaza Strip is known in the Bible as the land of the Philistines and the Philistine Plain. Isaiah 11:14 and Obadiah 19 tells us that we will not occupy the Gaza Strip permanently, if at all, until the Messianic Kingdom. And here's a map of the area. This is the Philistine Plain. It expands and contracts up and down the coastline depending on the strength of the Philistines. So that sits pretty much at its maximum right there. And this is the modern Gaza Strip. Now, Philistines don't live there anymore, but Gentiles do. Arab Gentiles do live in that section of the Philistine Plain we call the Gaza Strip today. Now, what does the scripture have to say about this? Well, the context of the following verses that I'm going to share with you is the Messianic Kingdom, speaking of Judah and Israel. and the institution of the Messianic Kingdom. Okay, what do these verses say? Isaiah 11:14a, they will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. In other words, we will not be occupying the Philistine plain. It will probably be limited. Well, who knows what it'll be, what the boundaries of the Philistine plain will be in the tribulation period. But we will have to swoop down on the slopes of the Philistine plain in order to possess it. And then Obadiah 19 follows up with the same thought. Those in the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau, that is on the east. And then they go on to say, and those in the Shvelah, understood, will possess the Philistine plain. Now the Shvelah is the lowlands between the Philistine plain and the Judean hills. But those in the Shvelah will now possess the Philistine plain. So Israel will not be occupying all the Philistine plain during the tribulation. We don't know what it's going to look like, but Gentiles will be living in that area, just as they do in the Gaza Strip today. So, because there will be no need to swoop down and possess territory that you already occupy. So we will not be occupying that territory during the tribulation period. And it appears that we will not be occupying it in its entirety until the kingdom. That includes the Gaza Strip. Therefore, I believe that the Gaza handover is in accord with biblical data. It will be temporary. Gaza will eventually become occupied by the Jewish people in accord with the eternal and unconditional Abrahamic covenant and its subset, the land covenant. However, that awaits the institution of the Messianic kingdom. So I don't criticize Israel for the land for peace, philosophy. I believe it is in accord with the biblical data that I've just shared with you. All right, let's look at November 21st, 2005. Ariel Sharon resigns from the Likud party and creates a new political party, Kadima. He asked President Katsav to dissolve parliament and schedule an early election, political turmoil in Israel. We've seen that before. Now, on the terrorism scene, an attempt to kidnap an IDF soldier was foiled when paratroopers patrolling near the Rajar village discerned a Hezbollah unit approaching. Private David Markowitz opened fire, killing all four, and then a heavy attack of mortars and Katyusha rockets ensued, and 9 soldiers and 2 civilians were injured. The terrorism continues. December 5, 2005, Palestinian Islamic Jihad kills 5 in Netanya again. Israel retaliates by barring Palestinians from entering Israel for a week. That may seem like a slap on the wrist, but many Palestinians depend upon employment in Israel. And so being barred from their employment for a week wreaks even more economic chaos upon them. December 27, 2005, 6 Katyusha rockets fired. A branch of a Palestinian organization connected with Al-Qaeda fires 6 Katyushas, damaging a house in Kiryat Shmona and a house in Matula. Again, this is on the northern border. In response, the IDF attacks a training base for the Popular Front south of Beirut. Now we enter 2006. January 4th, 2006. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon suffers a severe stroke and falls into a coma. Ehud Olmert assumes the role of acting Prime Minister and acting Chairman of Kadima. January 25th, Hamas wins a majority in the PA general elections. The U.S. and Israel and several European countries cut off aid to the Palestinians as the Islamist movement rejects Israel's right to exist. The quartet calls on Hamas to renounce violence, recognize Israel's right to exist, and accept all prior agreements. February 21, 2006, Ismail Haniyeh is sworn in as the Palestinian Prime Minister. March 28, 2006, the Kadima Party wins the Israeli elections and Ehud Olmert becomes Prime Minister. Voter turnout was the lowest ever, 63.2%. It's getting awful low. March 31st, 2001, in an interview with the British press, Hamas head Ismail Haniyeh calls for an end of requests to recognize Israel's right to exist. In other words, you guys keep asking us to recognize Israel's right to exist. We're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. Enough already. Don't even ask us anymore to do that. They're intransigent. May 21st, 2006. Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni meets Abbas in the World Economic Forum in Egypt. And this is Tzipi Livni. Abbas asserts that permanent arrangements are impossible without resolving the main issues of conflict, which are security, borders, Jerusalem, and refugees. He also claims Israeli unilateralism will increase violence and put an end to the two-state solution. Haniyeh says his government will maintain a ceasefire for many years if Israel withdraws to the 1967 borders. Now notice, Haniyeh is not offering a permanent ceasefire. He is not offering a peace treaty. He's just saying, if you give us what we want, we won't shoot at you for 2 years. And after 2 years, when we got our military stronger than ever, watch out. June 10th, 2006, Hamas ends a 16-month-long truce. So there it is. End of the peace process. The cross-border violence escalates near Gaza. The peace process has been dying a slow death for many, many years. June 25th, 2006, Corporal Gilad Shalit is kidnapped. Hamas, Popular Resistance Committee, and Army of Islam militants attacked Israeli forces in Israel, killing two Israeli soldiers and kidnapping Corporal Gilad Shalit. And here is Gilad Shalit. The terrorists have reached Israel through a tunnel from Gaza and demanded the release of an estimated 400 prisoners, mostly women and minors. After diplomatic efforts to secure the release of the kidnapped soldier, when those diplomatic efforts were unsuccessful, the IDF begins major operations in Gaza to rescue Shalit, to deter future Hamas attacks, and to weaken the Hamas government. These are operations Summer Rains, followed by Operation Autumn Clouds. They were both totally unsuccessful. June 28, 2006, a West Bank settler is kidnapped. Popular resistance committees announced that they had kidnapped a young West Bank settler and would kill him if Israel did not stop the Gaza operations. The very next day, June 29th, 2006, the kidnapped West Bank settler's body is found. Israel responds by arresting 64 Hamas cabinet ministers, parliamentarians, and other officials in the West Bank and in Jordan. July 2nd, 2006, a Hamas rocket hits the Israeli port city of Ashdod. It hit near a vacant school. This is the furthest north a Palestinian rocket has ever struck. The Israeli government approved prolonged activities against Hamas, against institutions and infrastructures used by terrorist organizations, and against rocket launching squads, and then in Gaza, and then Israeli operations in Gaza were expanded, bringing us to July 12th in 2006 and the Second Lebanon War. We're now back up on the Lebanese border. Hezbollah kidnaps two Israeli soldiers, Ehud Goldwasser and Eldad Regev, and kills three Israeli soldiers in Israeli territory, sparking the Second Lebanon War. Now Hezbollah demands the release of three Lebanese and other Arab prisoners in exchange for the return of Goldwasser and Regev. Prime Minister Olmert declares Hezbollah's attack an act of war. The 2006 Lebanon War began as a military operation in response to the abduction of the two Israeli reserve soldiers by Hezbollah, but the operation gradually strengthened and became a wider confrontation. The principal participants were the Hezbollah paramilitary units and the Israeli military. The conflict started on July 12, 2006, and continued until a United Nations brokered ceasefire went into effect on the 14th of August in 2006, and it formally ended on the 8th of September 2006 when Israel lifted its naval blockade of Lebanon. The war resulted in the pacification of southern Lebanon and in the weakness of Hezbollah, Hezbollah suffered serious casualties but managed to survive the Israeli onslaught. The G8 blames Hezbollah and Hamas for the destabilization of the region and calls upon them to halt their attacks. The G8 also calls upon Israel to be mindful of the strategic and humanitarian consequences of its actions. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and several Gulf states also blame Hezbollah for the war. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert issues calls to Hezbollah to return the kidnapped soldiers, to cease the terrorist attacks, and allow Lebanese troops to deploy along the border. The Lebanese government offers to deploy 15,000 troops to the Israel-Lebanon border in exchange for complete Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. The United Nations Security Council passes Resolution 1701, calling for an end to hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah. Israel and Hezbollah agree to the United Nations ceasefire. However, here's the practical implications of all that. However, the Lebanese defense minister declares that Lebanon has no intention of disarming Hezbollah, as required by the UNSC, the Security Council resolution. So how are you going to bring peace if you won't disarm one of the group on the northern border? How are you going to do that? Well, that's because this was stated because Hezbollah is stronger than Lebanon. The Hezbollah military forces are stronger than the Lebanese military forces. They really control Lebanon. So Israeli forces raid Hezbollah strongholds in southern Lebanon after continued Hezbollah violations of the ceasefire agreement. And so it continues. And this is a map of the Second Lebanese War. The circles indicate where the Israelis bombed in Lebanon. And you can see the bombing was concentrated heavily on the south against Hezbollah positions. All right, August 25th, 2006. Iran is developing nuclear weapons capability. So Israel starts preparing for a possible conflict. And here's a map of the Iranian nuclear resources. First of all, they possess nuclear power stations, both finished and under construction. There are a number of reactors, the green in the country, three reactors located in the country. There are uranium enrichment sites, two of them in the country. There is yellowcake storage facilities in the country. Yellowcake is a step in the processing of uranium. And they even own uranium mines, one in the south here and one in the middle of the country. So they have a lot of nuclear resources. September 30th, the last Israeli troops withdraw from Lebanon. The Second Lebanon War is over. All right, we've just got another minute or two to go. This might be a good time to call it quits, because we're right on the... We're just getting ready to enter 2007. So why don't I call it quits here at 2007, and we'll pick it up. We'll pick it up next session as we move into that. Excuse me. That's what I wanted to do there. We'll pick it up in our next session in as we move into that time frame, the year 2007. So thanks for being our students. We're always happy that you join us for these classes. We'll see you next session. Lahitra'od.